Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Concordia University. My name is Louise Dandurand, and I'm the Vice President, Research and Graduate Studies. Today, we are very fortunate to have Ms. Donna Brazil with us to speak about women and leadership in the age of Obama. In the words of Donna Brazil, and I quote, "I put my energy, voice, and spirit into fighting for anybody who wants to speak their voice. I don't care what the right wing, the left wing, or the chicken wing has to say." End of quote. She is a woman who speaks her mind. A 30-year veteran of politics and a tenacious social activist, Donna Brazil has worked on every presidential campaign from 1976 through 2000, when she served as campaign manager for former Vice President Al Gore. She is also a syndicated columnist and political commentator and adjunct professor of women and gender studies at Georgetown University. Nous sommes très heureux d'avoir Madame Brazil parmi nous au Congrès et à Concordia. Le Congrès dont le thème est le savoir branché. Et Madame Brazil, par son implication communautaire, son implication en politique, a démontré avec éloquence à quel point les liens entre l'université et la société sont précieux, utiles et nécessaires. I will now ask a friend of hers, Dr. Melinda Smith, Vice President of Equity Issue for the Canadian Federation of the Humanities and Social Sciences, to elaborate a little more regarding Ms. Brazil's accomplishment, as what I have said only scratches the surface. Thank you so much for joining us today, and I will now leave the floor to Dr. Melinda Smith.
Good afternoon, and thank you for your remarks, Dr. Dandurand. I would also like to thank you and your incredible colleagues here at Concordia for co-hosting this event and Congress as a whole. It has been a wonderful experience. I am Melinda Smith, and I'm the Vice President, Equity Issues at the Canadian Federation for the Humanities and Social Sciences. This year at Congress, the Equity Issues portfolio has focused on the theme of equality then and now, marking the 40th anniversary of the Royal Commission on the Status of Women, more popularly known as the Byrd Commission. The commission, chaired by journalist and broadcaster Florence Bayard Byrd, sought to identify issues affecting women across Canada. It also proposed solutions from pay equity and daycare to educational opportunities and the need for women in management and leadership roles, whether in the corporate sector, the NGO sector, or the academy. Many of the people who advocated for the implementation of these solutions were, like Donna Brazil, grassroots and community activists and engaged scholars. At the time in Canada, there was, in fact, only one woman in the federal cabinet. Today, women's organizations embattled by cuts, as well as MPs from all parties, are still calling action for action. Their voices underline the importance of political leadership in ensuring equity and social justice, and particularly women's issues, remain front and center on the political stage. As Inuit leader Mary Simon and Mohawk leader Ellen Gabriel reminded us yesterday, this topic of women in leadership for all women in all of our diversities is a key element to the theme Equality Then and Now. This is also why it is especially fitting that the last lecture of our series should be entitled Women and Leadership in the Age of Obama, and should be given by a woman who has been engaged and has blazed many trails at all levels of political life since the age of 9 years old when she first lobbied on behalf of children for a neighborhood playground. Ever since the assassination of Martin Luther King inspired her, Donna Brazil has been a participant in American politics for decades. She has worked on every Democratic presidential campaign from 1976 to 2000, serving as the campaign manager for Al Gore's 2000 presidential campaign, the first African-American woman to hold such a position. Currently, she is the vice chair of the voter registration and participation at the Democratic National Committee. Author of the best-selling memoir, Cooking with Grease, Stirring the Pots in American Politics, which uses the metaphor of cooking to dish up some important insights into politics and life, Ms. Brazil has been an adjunct professor at Georgetown University, where she teaches on women in politics. She is a frequent commentator on American political affairs, appearing on CNN and ABC, as well as NPR, National Public Radio. She is a regular columnist for newspapers, magazines, and blogs, including a contributor for Oprah's magazine, O, where she writes on women empowering themselves. She's also a longtime columnist for the feminist magazine, Ms. The Washingtonian magazine named her among the 100 most powerful women in the United States. Essence magazine included her in their top 50 most influential women. The O chose Ms. Brazil as one of its 20 most remarkable visionaries in the United States. Today, Ms. Brazil will speak to her unique perspectives on American politics, discussing the political landscape in the United States and the powerful role that women are playing in shaping that country. Please join me in welcoming to the stage Donna Brazil.
Thank you. 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 Bonjour. Well, I am a native of New Orleans, but where I'm from in my great home state, we just spoke broken English and Creole. Many of us did not learn French, but my neighbors to the south and west in the what we call Cajun country, Acadiana, roots of this great nation, they spoke perfect French. So thank you for having to put up with my inability to speak French here in Montreal. It's a great honor to be here at Concordia University, and I want to thank Dr. Smith for her kind and gracious introduction. I'm not used to addressing such a large audience. Usually I'm on CNN, so I'm a little nervous. But I'm fortunate to be here in balmy Montreal. By balmy, I mean, of course, I refer to the 81-degree Fahrenheit weather, not the people. The city of Montreal is a splendid setting for this conference, and Concordia is the featured jewel. Truth is, I love Canada. I'm proud to participate in this Congress of the best gathering of scholars in the humanities and social sciences. And whenever time permits, I often come here just to enjoy myself and your good company. This is my third visit to Montreal because I love jazz. And whenever I hear that there's a festival, a celebration of jazz, I like to come by and visit. And would I love to be here for We Want Miles, the Museum of the Fine Art tribute to Miles Davis this month. I also relish eating your oysters on Prince Edward Islands. And last summer, I finally ventured to Vancouver to look at preparations for the Winter Olympics. I had a lot of fun learning how to parasail. Montreal is also a 368-year-old city of the young, vibrant, a city of an eternal innovation. And so it is fitting to hold this Congress that seeks scholarly excellence, creativity, and leadership right here. I also would like to start by bringing personal greetings from President Barack Obama and our First Lady, Mrs. Michelle Obama. They want to convey their respect and admiration and that of our nation to Canadians for your heartfelt response earlier this year to the Haitians who were injured and displaced by the devastating earthquake. The President and Mrs. Obama were told by former President William Jefferson Clinton, otherwise known as the first black president, that, I quote, he said, "I bet on a per capita basis, Canada the number one in the world in helping Haitians." You should take pride in that, my friends, because we take pride in your outreach and your compassion. We have so much in common. We're North Americans. We're allies. We have shared common friends and common foes. It was at a nearby citadel in old Quebec City where Winston Churchill met with our president, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, back in August of 1943, clearly before my time, barely. But here on your soil, they decided the invasion date for invading Europe, or D-Day. These two men forged a friendship on which the fate of civilization depended. It was Franklin Delano Roosevelt who suggested that they come here to Canada. Here in Montreal, they also found common ground. You might call what they did connected understanding, the theme of this conference. So I can't help but think that if Sir Winston Churchill were still with us, that we would find him downing a whiskey at his namesake pub, the Sir Winston Churchill or Winnie's. Some here may be familiar with Crescent Street. Well, as a native of Louisiana, I was looking for it last night. But I am proud to be here. And there's one other thing we share, and I always mention this whenever I'm in Canada. We also share a Thanksgiving holiday. It's the fourth Thursday in November. Your Thanksgiving, I understand, is the second Monday of October. So we are, you likely know, the only two nations in the world with such a holiday. And though we share this common culture, this same holiday, it came about independently from one another. But it is a unique day for both of us. And those of us down south like to make it a day that we eat everything we can, and we wash it down with something cold. And when I say that, I now have a sinking feeling that it's going to be very difficult this Thanksgiving for my family and those who reside in the Gulf to have the kind of Thanksgiving that we are normally accustomed to. Oyster Rockefeller, oyster dressing, shrimp remoulade, shrimp po' boys, all of the wonderful crab dishes, crab bisque, and, of course, our famous Creole crab gumbo. All of that, all of those delicious recipes are now at stake because of the tragic accident that occurred down in the Gulf. So I hope you all continue to pray for us and to wish us well and to keep us in your thoughts as BP and others try to cap that well. But I'm here today because I want to talk about the age of Obama. Yes, the age of Obama, when women will finally blossom into full leadership, when we will continue our long journey towards equality for all, and when we will finally at last find equity in the workplace. And yes, when the doors to opportunities for women are finally blown wide open. And yes, when we're able to finally look at that glass ceiling and break it wide open. For many Americans, the 2008 presidential contest was a groundbreaking and historic election season. What an amazing moment in American history. And the election had so many levels of excitement. It was unpredictable until the final votes were cast and the electoral votes were announced. We made history, and now we desire to make the change, change that will make it possible for women and others to live to their fullest potential, and change that will help to encourage others to seek public office, and change that will usher in a new era with possibilities for all to finally enjoy the bounty of freedom. Now, I'm a Democrat. I make no apologies for that. I worked hard at being the vice chair of the Democratic Party, the number two party official in the United States of America. I've come a long way from being that little girl who grew up near the levees on the banks of the Mississippi River. Started, as Melinda said, at the age of 9, because I was inspired I was inspired by a great American, a great patriot, a great person, Martin Luther King, to try to make a difference and to help others live out their full potential. So you can imagine what it felt like as a superdelegate in 2008. Super, not because of our size. We didn't wear any capes like Batman. We didn't have the power of vision like Superman. We couldn't hear a pin drop, and no one wanted to see any of us in spandex. But still, we had one of the greatest seats to witness an amazing history. The two major political parties had to navigate uncharted waters, and yes, for the first time in U.S. history, we had women seriously compete for the highest political offices. Former U.S. Senator and now Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and Alaska former Governor Sarah Palin. You betcha. For Clinton, she went further than any woman in American history by winning 22 states, including Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Florida. She garnered over 18 million votes. And although Secretary Clinton failed to shatter the proverbial political glass ceiling, she provided 18 million tiny cracks in it that will one day be its ruin. I can tell you as a superdelegate and a party official that Hillary Clinton came very close to winning the Democratic primary, very close to becoming the first female president of the United States. She was the most effective debater during the contest. She never hesitated. She had the right answers, and she understood what was bothering the American public. She was always well prepared and could handle foreign and domestic affairs with superb intelligence. The race between Obama and Clinton energized the American electorate. But President Obama won in large measure because he built a larger coalition of first-time voters, young people, racial and ethnic minorities. This was an amazing electoral season, but Senator Clinton, Secretary Clinton, distinguished herself as far more than just a former First Lady. And today, she is championing the rights of women and girls all over the world as Secretary of State. She speaks up for us. She's our voice, whether in the Congo or talking truth to power when she has to take on Iran and North Korea and so many others. She's been superb on the Middle East issues, which are very complicated and demanding phenomenal diplomatic skills. She's made women's voices vital to U.S. diplomacy. And like President Obama, she's inspired a new generation of women to become actively engaged in the political process. We're proud of her leadership and her service. We are following her every day. Now for the Republican nominee. Senator John McCain of Arizona shocked the political world by announcing that he would put a woman on the Republican ticket, the first time ever. You all might recall that the Democrats put a woman on the ticket first in 1984. I worked on that campaign, too. I'm telling my age. I'm 50, so let's get it over with. Geraldine Ferraro was the first woman. Sarah Palin became the second woman. Now, former Governor Sarah Palin was a long shot and never appeared on any of the short list of potential nominees. Though controversial, Palin became the spark that quickly re-energized a floundering campaign, and she helped John McCain mobilize the party's conservative base, and she proved to be an effective spokesperson on the campaign trail for the conservative base in American politics. She was the spark that re-engaged conservatives. After 8 years of George Bush and Dick Cheney, they wanted change too, and she became their change agent. A few months ago, Governor Palin decided to step down from politics But many of us believe that she will consider another run for higher office in the near future. For now, she is a best-selling author, and she's leading the Tea Party movement. She got her own show on the Discovery Network, so who knows where that will lead. Maybe she'll discover that seeing Russia from her house is not a political experience. But I think that's just wishful thinking. Palin's voice dominates conservative thinking in America. She tweets, they jump. She puts it on Facebook, they holler. Though she often speaks of her role as a wife and a mother, Palin has yet to give any significant speech on women's issues or gender equality. And I think it's safe to report that Palin is not a fan of the modern women's movement. But that's her loss. And we know that there are many in the conservative movement that wish to see the gains that we've made, that wish to see the era that we're beginning to embark upon. They would wish that we would go back, but we're not going back. The 2008 election season was good for American politics. It was good for women. It was good for minorities. As our fate are often linked for a long time. What's best for minorities or racial minorities or ethnic groups should also be good for women and vice versa. It's the community of the marginalized that benefits whenever we are given positions of power and authority. So I know while some women were distraught that we didn't elect Hillary Clinton, I think it's short-sighted to claim that President Obama's victory was not also a victory for women and girls all across America. So let me reflect that I never thought I would see this day, the election of the United States of America, first black president. And it has been a journey and a milestone we reached. By being able to speak up, by being able to energize and empower people who were often marginalized or left on the sideline. This was not something I envisioned when I was a child who lived in the segregated Deep South, but this is something that our parents prepared us for. This is a moment of transformation. This is a moment to usher in a new era. And when Barack Obama took office on that chilly day back in the winter of 2009, he assumed the presidency amid an array of challenges unparalleled in our lifetimes. But he made sure that women would have a seat at the table. And under his leadership, President Obama has put women in top areas of national concerns, from revitalizing the United States economy to passing major health care reform, to improving America's image around the world, protecting our homeland, and as I speak, protecting our environment. These are women. President Obama, on the economy, he has Ms. Roma. On the environment, he has Ms. Jackson or Ms. Browner. On Homeland Security, Secretary Napolitano. On health care, he had an advisor, Nancy DiPaolo, who actually helped craft the legislation. And the spokesperson, the leading spokesperson, the woman who will be now in charge of guiding his implementation, Secretary Sebelius. On reengaging our allies, rebuilding our alliances, Secretary Clinton. I'm waiting for him to appoint a woman the head of defense, but I'm still not ready yet to accept the position. But we still face many challenges in this age of Obama. Women and girls today are over 50% of the population. We outnumber men in undergraduate education, We earn over 57% of all bachelor degrees. We make up nearly half of the United States workforce and over 60% of all women work full time. And studies show that women make 80% of consumer purchasing decisions. Yet even with the increasing participation of women in the workforce, or education, or in the American economy itself, women in the United States still earn only 78 cents for every $1 a man earns. And the wage gap grows for women of color. African-American women earn only 69 cents, and Latina women earns only 62 cents for every dollar earned by a white male per week. This wage gap is even more critical for American families, as women are now the primary or co-breadwinners in nearly two-thirds of American families. And women and girls continue to lag in key sectors that are key to revitalizing and rebuilding our economy in the 21st century. For example, women hold only 27% of jobs in science and engineering, and gender gaps in science, technology, education, and engineering and math, we call them the STEM fields, especially in the physical sciences, these gaps begin to emerge in middle school. We have to correct that. That's why in the age of Obama, we need women at the table. We need women who will speak up and women who will address these significant challenges that we face. Violence against women and girls remain all too prevalent and deadly. 1.5 million women are raped and are physically assaulted by an intimate partner annually. 1.5 million female high school students have experienced physical dating violence. And one quarter of all children are exposed to some form of family violence over their entire childhood. Until we pass the Affordable Care Act, otherwise known as Health Care for All, women suffered insurance rate discrimination, and even millions of women with health insurance lacked the proper coverage for basic preventive care and health needs like maternity care. And domestic violence was considered a pre-existing condition. No longer. We now have a health care bill that will begin to usher us into the 21st century. For all these reasons, the needs of women and girls must remain our focus, must remain the focus of President Obama and the federal government. President Obama is committed to ensuring that women will remain at the table. About a year ago, I was invited to the White House, where I witnessed the president signing an executive order creating a White House Council on Women and Girls. And let me share with you some of the highlights of this important council, which ensures that there's a government-wide approach to addressing the needs of women and girls. Instead of a single department and office, the council includes all of the cabinet-level agencies. It ensures that all of the White House policy offices are involved. And it is chaired by none other than senior advisor to the President of the United States, a good friend, a woman who introduced the President to his wife, Valerie Jarrett, which means she has juice. Now, each agency has designated leaders who work within the agency to keep a focus on women and girls. This is real leadership. This is a real commitment. This is change that will ultimately usher in a new era. In addition, the council has worked closely with other agencies to make sure that women are at the table in those agencies. So it doesn't matter if you're in a small agency or large agency like the Defense Department or Health and Human Services, Education, women are at the table. And this administration has provided the leadership on work family issues. They also promote effective measures to reduce and prevent violence against women, and to reform in our healthcare system as we implement this major policy goal to build healthy families and improve women's health. So let me sum it up. President Obama has done a good job. I continue to give President Obama excellent grades. He has not gone beyond a B minus. Some days I'm hard on the president. Have to be hard on him. Got to make him work for my love. But the president, and this is just the beginning, we still have two and a half more years, and by my calculation, four more. You betcha. The president signed the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act as his first bill to ensure that no women face the discrimination and injustice that led Lilly Ledbetter, who had worked 20 years at Goodyear Tire Company, to simply learn that she was making less money. We're going to find a way to ensure that every woman is paid for comparable work. We're not going to allow this pay gap to continue. He created an equal pay task force. President Kennedy was the first back in 63 to establish a commission on the status of women, and President Obama is continuing in that tradition. He's going to provide the leadership. As I mentioned, he's appointed women to key cabinet positions, but he also appointed the first ever White House advisor on violence against women. And he lifted the global gag rule, and he's made maternal and child health a priority of our global agenda. And yes, last year he nominated Judge Sonia Sotomayor, the first Latina to the United States Supreme Court who was confirmed, and he just nominated Elena Kagan to replace retiring Justice John Paul Stevens. This is a remarkable record and also a foundation to build on. We still need more women to serve. I think Canada is right there with us. Embarrassingly, only 20% of all elected officials are women. We got to do something about that, not just in America, but here in Canada as well. Now, we have a record number of women serving in the 111th Congress, a record number of women serving in the Senate. And, of course, I am so proud that in the House, the largest chamber, it is led by none other than Speaker Nancy Pelosi of California. She wears Prada. And don't cross her. I would cross Dick Cheney before crossing Pelosi. But Gloria Steinem, one of the founders of the modern women's movement, recently wrote an appeal to activists, the odds of bumping into a woman in Congress are still just 1 in 6. Altogether, the United States ranks, and embarrassingly, as I say, it's embarrassing, 71st in the world in terms of women's representation in national legislators or parliaments. This is out of 189 countries with direct elections. Canada, you're right up there with us. We have to get our act together. So we still need more women in leadership positions, not just to stand for election, but also to advocate, once elected, to support the majority needs of women and girls. We have so much unfinished business, work that can only be done by those who dare to believe in a better world, those who are willing to push the envelope, and those who are ready to press the elevator forward to hurry history, those who are not afraid to speak up, and if need be, to bring in your own chair when you walk into a room and there's no place at the table for you. We must find ways to encourage women to serve, to help lead, and to ensure that those old barriers are removed and that we have a new path to full equality. And it's time that we recognize, whether you live here or in America, that women will make the difference. We can make the difference, and we can become the change. Our long struggle for freedom is not over. We still have a ways to go. The serious obstacles that remain in our quest to break fully these steel-constructed glass ceilings that hamper our ability to lead must finally be dealt with. And these are obstacles that are not enormous, but they are a burden, because women are often held to a different, or I should say, a higher standard, such as having to defend our appearance or wardrobe. First of all, let me tell you, I go on CNN, I'm always fully dressed from head to toe, down to the stockings, got to keep the hair together, put some in the ears that match the neck, the whole nine yards. I walk in the studio sometime and look at a guy got on jeans and tennis shoes. I say, how could this be? You went to the soccer match? I'm not even dressed to go to the opera. But you can go on TV. There you have it. We have to work to overcome old traditional stereotypes of women as being the weak agenda. That is something we all have to work on. God forbid if in our demeanor or behavior we show any emotion. I was once on TV, and I saw Mitt Romney, who was a presidential candidate. He was just sobbing. And they said, oh, he's so compassionate. Sobbing. His hair never moved, but he was sobbing. Hillary Clinton got on TV right before the New Hampshire primary to reinforce why she was in the race. And a few hours later, the guys were saying, she is weak. She's emotional. Boy, she must have PMS. I was on that night, and I said, that's not PMS. I know PMS. We must still prove in our background or resume that we're up to the job or position, otherwise known as, is she really experienced enough to handle the job or position? We must prove that we can compete like any man, especially in developing political strategy, educational strategy, research, raising money, resources. We have to often go above board. We have to be more than perfect. Sometime when we're trying to just become more viable players, trying to get positive coverage, people still treat us as if we look the part, we can actually do the job versus what's on our resume, what's in our background. We have a lot of work to do, and we know that. But we also know that we can better position ourselves. We can create support structures. We can create networks. And yes, we know that we have the experience to make a difference. We also need to polish off and really help to push our women's organizations and leaders to really enter the modern era and to bring more young women into the process and to re-strategize our issues, represent them, and to ensure that our message is timely for the 21st century. Finally, we have to support one another. Stop pulling one down. Stop frowning upon a woman who's already gotten in the door. I tell my friends, when I get in the door, I keep my shoe right there so I can keep it open for another woman to come in. We have to learn how to console and nurture and inspire one another. So are we there yet in the age of Obama? Not quite. But as the old saying goes, we've come a long way, baby, and we're going to keep on marching. We're going to keep on pushing until we finally break once and for all the glass ceiling. As I sat on the platform during the inauguration of the 44th President of the United States, I found myself looking out at the sea of people who came to bear witness to that historic moment. As I gently whispered to one of my younger sisters who attended as my guest and who supported and voted for Hillary Clinton during the primary season, I said, Lisa, one day we will return and we will see a woman take the Oval Office. She still believed in the American dream. I do as well. It is a dream rooted in our history. It is a dream rooted in our struggle, and it is a dream that we will all make happen. But this is a dream that we also believe must include women. It must include women. Let me say that one of my favorite heroines when I was a kid. I had so many. I could count on my left hand, my mother, my grandmothers, and my aunts, and my sisters, and Fannie Lou Hamer, and Rosa Parks, and Harriet Tubman, and Sojourner Truth, and Ida B. Wells. And then I would count another hand, and I had another group of women. They were the people that I never met, but I still liked them. The other women were spirit. These were the women who I thought would add flavor, spice. One of them, of course, was Dorothy Irene Hite. She was a tenacious woman. She was smart. She was brilliant. She worked with Eleanor Roosevelt. She was there when Dr. King delivered his famous I Have a Dream speech. And yes, she was there throughout the historic fight for civil rights, for women's equality. And just recently, she passed away at the age of 98. Dorothy Hite, when she went into the hospital, they said, "Come to the hospital. Dr. Dorothy Hite is about to pass." And we wanted her friends to be around her. We got there on a Friday afternoon, and Dorothy Hite rallied. 2 weeks later, they said, "Dorothy Hite is on deathbed. Got to come back. Got to come and see her." Got there, Dorothy Hite rallied. Dorothy Hite had 3 curtain calls. And before she left, she wanted us all to know that greatness is not measured simply because of who you are. It is measured by the struggles that you are able to overcome. She was a visionary. She was a woman who lived her dreams and believed in the beauty of others to live their dreams as well. So let us leave this Congress, this wonderful experience of shared insights and ideas, to go back and believe in one another and respect women in all aspects of society. Let us rise together and believe that we can pull more women through the political pipeline, that we can encourage women to serve and to lead and to take their seats at the table. And let our two nations, the United States of America and Canada, continue to strengthen the bond of friendship and mutual respect as we share this beloved continent. So I just want to thank you once again for extending the invitation for me to participate in this important Congress. And I look forward to your questions, your comments, and of course, because I am a native of New Orleans, any recipes or any music you wish to share. Thank you, merci beaucoup. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. You have time? Okay. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. All right. All right. Thank you. Thank you. Here. All right. This is a good part. So, Oprah, how you been? Fine, Ellen. Oh, good, Oprah.
Thanks, Donna, for cooking up some fabulous gumbo and political gumbo. We do have time for about 10 minutes of questions, and I would like to invite you to the microphones, if you will, please.
Ooh-wee, I see your legs. They're all good.
Thanks. Historically, many empires, notably the British, worked on a divide-and-conquer policy. Some people saw the presidential election of Obama and Clinton in those terms. And it's frequently when minority groups are asking for rights, frequently one group is pitted against another. Some saw the health debate in those terms, that the middle class was pitted against the have-nots, etc. If you look at the academic world, although women now outnumber men, that's not true in terms of faculty. And there's been a lot of resentment when some kind of quota system is used in order to try to increase the number of women academics. So my question to you really is, how do we forge ahead in improving opportunities for women without causing a backlash amongst men?
First of all, thank you for your question. And I think if you look at what's happening in the United States right now, there is a backlash. There's a backlash to not just the election of President Obama, but there's also a backlash to some of the policy prescriptions that he has put forward to try to heal an ailing economy and to try to get the country back on its feet again. The only way to, I think, to bring people together is to try to reach them where they are and to let them understand that the changes that we're seeking, whether it's getting more women into leadership positions, not just in academia, but art, the law, all of the other, I mean, women outnumber men in the law, and yet when you look at the number of female partners, it's less than 12% in some cases. So I think that we have to begin to educate the public. We got to fertilize the electorate. We got to do a better job of giving people an opportunity to understand why it's important that women should be part of the solution, part of the foundation of society, versus being marginalized and being excluded. Now, I'm a politician, so I'm going to be very nice at first and say that politics is about adding and multiplying. It should not be about division and subtraction. We should add more people to the process, add more women into the pipeline, and we should multiply the effects of having diversity, of having people from all backgrounds in the room. We have been catering for too long in our history to the wishes and whims of men who believe that by adding a little dash of this and a little bit of that, somehow or another, it will make them less than. All we're trying to do is give y'all more of what you've already had, but not at our expense. And if we're not able to utilize the talents of all of society, then we're operating at half gear or half baked. And no offense, because I complimented you on your legs. But at some point, you need to let some women in. Let me give y'all an example. I was watching TV this morning. I love watching it in French because I didn't understand a word, but I got the concept. And we were talking about how to cap a spill. They said, you know what? You could tell that these are guys coming up with these, you know, junk shot, hood, top cat. They said, well, you know, women, we know about tampons. Can somebody make a tampon and just plug the well? And you know we have super absorbency? We have, look, without, you know, getting into too, as they say, TMI, why not have women to share their insights, their knowledge, the education? And I do believe that we can find ways to come together. But right now, we know that, in at least in my country, partisan politics, you know, not only, sells, but it is, electorally speaking, it's a very important component of our politics. And it's unfortunate, because I think the American people, by and large, hunger for people to come together. They hunger to see the world a much better place. They hunger to see more people included, more people involved, but they're scared. And so fear, we have to address the fears. We have to address the fear of men thinking that, oh, my daughter, my wife, my sister, my aunt, my mother might be in a room when I have to make the decision. Hell, what you think you're doing already? Your daughter, your wife, your mother, you know, they're helping you. So bring them in. We have to address the fears. Often when I would run campaigns in my youth, I'm semi-retired. I used to tell my brothers, baby, put it back. I really don't want it. Just step back. I'm just trying to help you figure out how to get from here to there. That is campaign strategy, after all. Put it. They were nervous. I said, I'm not going to make you don't have to make my coffee sugar, because I like it with chicory. You wouldn't even understand what that you know. But nor will you make any woman in this department or in this campaign make your coffee. I changed the entire landscape.
I changed the attitudes. I changed the office. And we became a healthy campaign. It's healthy to include people, who've been omitted, and in some cases, legally prevented. So when we talk about, you know, oh, my God, we're going to make somebody upset because we have quarters. Well, excuse me, if the door, if you're not going to open the door and put your foot back to let other people in, then we may have to get the door down some other way or figure out a way to crack open a window. And that's what the laws are about, helping to ensure that those doors are open and that people can come through. So I would say that if we can't find a path to include more women, put more women in the pipeline, get more women to serve in leadership roles. And women, we better be prepared, too. So don't talk a good game and then you can't live up to what you've been talking about. That's why I tell people I'm the world's best cook, okay? Get me in the kitchen. I can smoke it. I can burn it. I can bake it. I can sizzle it. But put me on a campaign. I campaigned in 48 states. Two more, I would have become Miss USA without the bikini. But I didn't go into a state and say, oh, I can't do it because I don't know anything about North Dakota. I got to North Dakota. I said, what do y'all like, corn? I said, oh, let me do some cornmeal tomorrow. I said, now, let's talk about this campaign because I'm a cook. I'm not going to starve here in North Dakota. But then I could still work on them campaigns, okay? So I would hope that you, my friend, Mr. Lades, I would hope that you would help us usher in this new era. Because it is ripe for possibilities. But we need men like you who are open to having more women included and involved in the process. We need you to help educate your fellow brothers, uncles, cousins, and others and say, you know what, I think it's time for change. You're the best change agent, and I'm glad you're here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for your presentation. I want to just comment and leave you with a question.
Okay.
So I was at the inauguration. I am a first-generation Canadian. My father is a Palestinian refugee. My mother is an African immigrant. And so the moment when I was there was not lost on me. When I saw Malia coming down the aisle on the big screen, I was reminded of The Bluest Eye, Toni Morrison's The Bluest Eye, and I thought to myself, wow, this is an amazing moment. Perhaps now, you know, little black girls, instead of wishing for blue eyes, can wish for a blue coat, which brings me to my point, the issue of you talked about women getting into politics, but I'd like for you to speak to maybe some of the institutional barriers around economic, you know, access to power, because it's all well and good for us to talk as women, but it's so generic when we say women, which women? And another issue was you mentioned the issue of Hillary Clinton addressing the Middle East, a very complicated, you know, issue of matters. And I just wanted to say you encouraged us to speak our mind and put our thoughts out there. I think I'm in good company with the likes of Desmond Tutu, Aung San Suu Kyi, Jimmy Carter, and Nelson Mandela as of yesterday, who stated that, you know, justice is missing in Palestine. And certainly when we talk about the besieged people of Gaza and anywhere in the world, no different than for African Americans when they were fighting for their civil rights. It wasn't complicated then, and it's not complicated now. Justice is never complicated.
You know, one of the most difficult constituencies that when I was young and you know, up until 2 years ago, was trying to encourage not just, you know, women to vote or people of color to vote or young people to vote, but going into some of the poorest neighborhoods in America and telling people why their vote would make a difference. Your vote is your voice. And in society, if you don't vote, you really don't count. Because nobody looks to your neighborhood if people are not participating in the electoral process. So you have to make voting about empowerment. But we also have to find more ways to include marginalized community and what I call into the mainstream of society by giving them access to the same resources that everyone else is able to have access to. And that's part of what we have to do in politics or in academia and any other profession is that we can't just complain that society is unfair, because I am living proof that it is unfair, but you can, you know, turn the tables. My mother was a maid. My mother cleaned homes down there in the area of New Orleans where the old plantations used to exist. My father was a janitor. He cleaned floors. He mopped floors. He cleaned windows and toilets. And yet, with their 9 kids, they worked. And they taught us that, you know what? Get an education. You work hard. You respect us. And my mother will always say, you better respect me. Because you can go out there and break the law and go to jail. Or you can violate those 10 commandments. You break the law, you're going to jail. Violate those 10 commandments, you're going to hell. But you break my rule? She said, I'll put you in a place that is hotter than hell, further than a jail, and we didn't know where the hell that was. Some of us thought it was the state of Mississippi. But they empowered us. They encouraged us. And likewise, now that's why I spend a lot of time empowering, encouraging. You know, when I received those tickets to the presidential inaugural, I didn't just give them to my friends. I went across that Anacostia River in Washington, D.C., the poorest community not far from the United States Capitol. And I said, you know what? I want to go find those same kids, the kids like myself who grew up poor, those parents with nothing who ride the bus every day. So it's our responsibility to become the change that we see. And in terms of the crisis right now in the Middle East, and, of course, the incident that took place over the weekend, I think those leaders and many more should condemn what happened. After all, they were bringing humanitarian relief. And I hope that we get to the bottom of it. But for now, I think that it is a difficult diplomatic dance that is still going on in the Middle East that requires some justice to the Palestinian issue, but that also has to be met with some acknowledgement that Israel also wants security. So I think we can do both. And I don't know how we get back to the road to some kind of peace process, but by ignoring the Palestinians and by not having one spokesperson and by the Israelis not listening to the world, we're at a stalemate. And I hope that Secretary Clinton and President Obama and others will put maximum pressure so that we can get us back to the road to peace. Now, you're pressuring me. Now, give me a reason why. I feel you. I feel you. I feel that pressure.
It's cool. We have...
I can't do 30 seconds. I'm not on CNN. No, this is a large audience. Well, you got lunch? Is it a lunch date?
Yeah, okay.
I'm going to take these last 5. I'll try to chill.
So just ask your question as quickly as you can, and then ask your question.
Hi, Nathan Fong. I had the pleasure of working with you in 88 and Dukakis campaign. So I commend you on your career. I know how hard it is to get to where you are now.
Thank you.
I wanted to know your opinion on the Tea Party, because when I watch them on television, they don't seem to have the diversity that other groups have. And then yet they take on Mitch McConnell. I think McConnell's an endorsed candidate, lost as well. So I wondered where their ire is coming from, because they seem to be poised to have a big influence this year and perhaps 2012. Thank you.
Well, first of all, after two consecutive electoral defeats, the 06 and the 0 election cycles, the Republican Party is in somewhat of a soul-searching moment. I'm not a Republican, so I'm trying to do this with a straight face. The Tea Party movement, some believe it is the old movement that Barry Goldwater initiated back in the 60s as a counter movement to the civil rights struggle. It's somewhat ironic that maybe they set out the 06 and 08 election and we didn't hear from them, but when the country was accumulating this huge deficit, when we were, you know, invading Iraq, we didn't hear. When we were giving away, you know, tax credits to big oil companies, when we were giving people money to take our jobs offshore, they were not rallying. So they found their voice last year. They're angry as hell. They don't want to take it anymore. And they are now threatening to divide the Republican Party. Now, right now, they are operating within the Republican Party. They are operating under this purity test that they want. You have to be pure as the driven Tea Party. This is not mint tea or green tea. This is real Tea Party. And so I try to be very respectful of the fact that as Americans, we have rights to free speech. I cross the line with the level of incivility, with some of the hatred, with some of the mean-spiritedness, and some of the outright, you know, threats that they make during political discourse, spitting on elected officials, using the N-word, calling elected officials nigger, calling elected officials faggot, saying that threatening phone calls, acts of vandalism, whether it's attributed to the Tea Party movement or not, people believe that there are elements of the Tea Party movement, there are people who are exploiting it to create this, what I call this friction. So my reaction to the Tea Party movement has been to, you know what, keep sipping that. Keep whatever you're sipping, sip, okay? But we should not all get drowned in tea, because this is not a movement that brings people together, it divides. This is a movement that has to be at times chastised, as recently as 2 weeks ago when Rand Paul could not answer yes or no on a basic question of civil rights. So I'm going to let the Republican Party right now deal with its Tea Party movement, but I also believe that there's an enthusiasm gap on the left among progressive groups that we have to, at least I believe that some of us should address, so that we can have another counterbalance to the Tea Party movement. But that's where I'm at on that. I don't demagogue them. I don't know what's in their hearts. I don't know what really they're mixing up with that tea. But some days I say, no, not no tea for me. Yes.
Thank you. When you were running the Dukakis campaign, I was in Vermont running for the U.S. House and had the support of women like Shirley Chisholm, C. Dolores Tucker, and Florence Kennedy, and ran like Faye Williams. But my roots go back three generations here, and I'm a returnee and have founded the first black think tank here in Canada. I've been very disappointed, and that's why I really wish you would come back again and talk about the color ban here. In Montreal, there is one black fireman. So if we had a woman fire person, then we would have a 100% increase in color. It's not something that's recognized or talked about here because of the history of thinking of how broad-minded we are and open and blind to any color and all this. We really need you. It's more than just the situation for women. It's the situation for women of color, visible minorities in Canada. There isn't the long hatred kind of background of the United States, but there's a somewhat disingenuous inability to see that you're not working beside anyone of color. Thank you for your remarks.
I had Miss Augustine stand up, my sister, as you know her. She also gave me a briefing on that same subject. Thank you for your service. And I believe you are now responsible for the Fairness Commission, and this is one of the areas that you're working on. So I hope to learn more. And yes, I do read a lot about Canada. I was stunned to read about the cross burning over there in the East. I've been stunned to read about the lack of representation. I was stunned to even see that in terms of female representation, you're pretty much where we are in the United States. So I do worse. I don't know about that. We're both really down there. But I do believe that we can learn from one another. And we've made some significant, you know, strides in the United States in terms of race relations. We're not post-racial. We are not post-racial. But we have come a distance from where we started. And I think it all starts with history, acknowledging some of the painful lessons of the past, but also finding a new vocabulary so we can talk about racial issues in ways that do not put people immediately on defense, but get them talking about how we make this a better society for all of us, for our children, And so it is an area that I have an enormous amount of interest in, and I look forward to learning even more, since I love your oysters, honey. Yes, sir.
In your comments, you mentioned that the politics of women were also the politics of the marginalized, and you rated the Obama administration fairly high, or B-minus, I think, on women's issues. What about other marginalized groups in the United States, in particular gays and lesbians, in light of the recent issues with Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and Latinos and illegal immigrants in light of the situation in Arizona? And also, if you ever want to come to Montreal and cook, you can come to my kitchen. I will cook with you any day.
I'll send my spices up in advance. We Louisianians are also biased toward our spices, which is why we're all fighting so hard. Look, I think the president has enormous challenges. If you ask the average African American right now, suffering 18% unemployment in some cities like Detroit, half of all black men unemployed, and some in black youth, Latino youth, unemployed, you know, unemployment approaching 60% in some areas. So if you ask any group, be it black, Latino, be it, you know, women, be it any marginalized group, are they satisfied? No. But I do think that we're making progress. And part of the political process is trying to find, you know, coalitions, find allies, but it also requires presidential and congressional leadership. And I think some of the groups believe that the president has moved too slowly on addressing their concerns. Now, there are members of the Congress, the House that I used to work in, they say, God, we don't want to touch any more hot-button issues. We're done. We had to do the economy. We had to do health care. We had to do climate change. You mean we got to do Don't Ask, Don't Tell? You mean we have to do INDA? They're like, no. So, yes, they're going to be pushed, and part of what the constituency groups are out there doing, they're pushing, whether it's on GLBT issues, whether it's on issues of fairness for minorities, whether it's on gender equality issues for women. We got to keep pushing. Just because you put someone in office that you like, and I put a lot of people in office I like, but I have also put them in office that I like and kept pushing them. I sat down with my congresswoman this weekend. I said, Eleanor, come on over. I'm cooking. Because I want to just keep in touch. You can't vote for someone one day and say, oh, God bless you. No, you have to keep pushing. And I hope that we keep that spirit going in America, whether it's on immigration, whether it's on the health care debate, that which is bloody. It was huge. It took us a year. And part of that whole campaign was dealing with all of these fears and all of the misinformation and the outright lies. We're going to kill grandma. We're going to kill grandma. Then the last 48 hours was abortion. And the Catholic bishops and the Catholic nuns say, no, there's nothing there. And the bishops say, yes. Well, you know, who do you trust? The nuns. So my answer is simple. It's that we got to keep pushing. We got to keep building coalitions. And we got to keep advocating for the change that we voted for. A change in electorate must continue to engage the public in change and to push the leaders to actually lead. Just because someone is elected doesn't necessarily mean that they're a leader. Some people grow into their position. Some people never, ever grow into their position. Got to keep pushing them. So while I don't give you the actual grade, it's because I still believe that that part of the agenda has not been formalized and finalized. And immigration reform, we haven't even touched it yet. So there you have it. And thanks for it, and I'll be in your kitchen. All right, we got two more.
We'll take those two questions, and then both of them at the same time, and then you can
wrap it up. I hear you. Lord have mercy. Get me the can and tell me to wrap it up. Lord.
First of all, I'm a big fan of yours on TV, and you're even better in person. Really good.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Thank you.
Will the current crisis in the Gulf undermine the presidency of President Obama to the point that he will be challenged in his own party in 2012? And if so, would it be by a woman that you may happen to know?
Mm-hmm. Okay, good question. I'm going to take the last question, then I'll answer both. Per Melinda Smith. Thank you, sir. Yes, ma'am.
It's a pleasure seeing you here. And you've empowered a lot of us today, especially those of us who have been carrying the torch, fighting for our rights, and standing up to the powers there be. And I remembered you talking when you spoke about your childhood. But I should tell you that as a child, I remember asking my mother, "Mommy, why I see people bowing to the Queen?" And she told me it was authority. I said, "Well, if no one bows to you, ain't bowing to nobody and no woman." And I really, really enjoy your presence here, and you have energized many of us. I can speak for myself also that you've energized us. I would like to ask you a question about the immigration with displaced American landed citizens over there in terms of the immigration policies. And some of these people have been displaced over there as a result of circumstances. I'd like to also ask about the children and family rights. What's your framework on those topics?
Immigration policy is going to be a very difficult issue for us to put on the agenda and have a conversation without it exploding and spilling over to the next 2 years. And part of it is that, you know, most Americans, I don't know if you read recently, in terms of the Arizona law, 62% of the American people think that it's okay to racially profile a group of people, to pull them over and to check their immigration papers without them, you know, being suspects in a crime or what have you. And giving police the authority to determine whether or not you are illegal or versus you, and giving citizens the right to sue if they don't think the police are doing it. Now, let's start with the fact that most Americans believe that our borders are not secure, that we need more stronger enforcement at the border, and that the 20 million, maybe 12 million or so undocumented workers should be sent home, which, by the way, we got a budget crisis. Think about trying to round up 20 million people, sending them home. Good luck. We need sensible, fair, equitable, common sense immigration reform. Our borders are broken. We know that. But we also know that there must be a path for some to, whether it's getting in the back of the line or figuring out a way to get them, you know, a path to citizenship. I personally do not support the deportation of millions of undocumented workers. I don't think we should reward them, but I also think that we should find a path to citizenship. Many of them are contributing to the tax base of the country or where they live. And many of these kids, you might have seen on TV, when the little girl stood up when Mrs. Obama was there with Mrs. Calderon, and she said, "My mom doesn't have all her papers. Will you send her home?" And now there are attempts to even challenge the 14th Amendment. The 14th Amendment guaranteed everyone born in the country equal justice under the law and citizenship. And yet there are people who are challenging that for children of undocumented workers. So I'm not the resident expert on immigration reform in the country. I'm sure I will be in the next couple of months once these topics. Like, I wasn't the resident expert on Afghanistan and the regional provinces and tribes until we, you know, went to Afghanistan. I was not the expert on Iraq, and I'm not the expert. But you'd be amazed what you have to learn in the span of, you know, debating it on television. Because my approach to debating any issue on television is not just to go with my own feelings, but to figure out the facts, to get as much information as possible, and then try to enlighten people with my own, you know, analysis and give people an opportunity to share their thoughts as well. So it is going to be a very contentious issue, and we'll see what happens. Now, let me just say this. I'm a Gulf resident. I was born in New Orleans, born in Charity Hospital. When Hurricane Katrina made landshore, I was in Washington, D.C., on the phone, screaming with folks, including my dad, to get out of harm's way. Leave. Leave. As a little girl, I remember when Hurricane Betsy made landfall. I know what it feels like to have that drowning sensation when the water reaches that level in your home, when everything just burst open. I mean, when I was a kid, I thought The Wizard of Oz was a scary movie. I mean, because Dorothy, you know, running from a storm. I was Dorothy. And so the notion that your family is there, some of them unable to get away, and then they, you know, waiting for days to find out if they made it out safely. The experience in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, for those of us who are from the Gulf Coast, our families, is that not only did our government fail us, but people forgot about us. I mean, the whole city was underwater. 1,500 people died, okay? We all know someone, whether in your family or friends, who died, okay? So when BP, when the rig exploded and BP announced that there was no spilling of oil, we all like, how could that be? It's a well. It goes into the ground. And if it's in the ground and it's exploding, something's spilling. 2 days later, we finally hear something from the White House. Now, yes, the Coast Guard was there. The Navy was there. They were trying to contain the, you know, the fire. They were trying to rescue the workers. So, yes, there were people from the Obama administration or the federal government on the spot. But we didn't hear from the president publicly for a couple of days. And that silence was deafening. It was like, ooh, ooh. You know, it really rankled some of us. And trust me, we all know how to pick up the phone and call the White House and email. But for some reason, it was BP's responsibility, sure. It was BP's obligation, sure. It was BP's accident, sure. But it's our Gulf Coast. It is not just our source of water, our seafood, our livelihood, source of wildlife. It is who we are, okay? It is who we are. Now, it's so emotional and so spiritual that when you want to tell somebody that maybe don't know, but everything about those marshlands, the that's who we are. Every child experienced that part of the world. That's who we are. That ties us to this earth. It's in my blood. It's in my veins. And yet, there was such indifference that, you know, you just sat there every day and saying, and then your sisters and brothers are calling you saying, we smell it. And they're worried that it's going to get into what? Their waterways. Now, everybody along America drink, go to the bathroom, flush their commodes, comes all, y'all know that giant Mississippi River? Then it snakes its way, and we do this. Pour it. That's who we are, too. We actually drink the water. We eat the food. We have four seasons, and it's not winter, spring, summer, and fall. It's crawfish, shrimp, crab, and oyster. And so we thought that the administration was relying too much on BP. Now, I think the president has done a better job over the last 10 days in articulating just not just our frustration, but also our deep concern that this could be the end of the Gulf of Mexico as we know it. BP said 5,000, now it's 768,000 gallons. So this is so personal that we don't, those of us who are Democrats, we're not angry, but we're frustrated that the administration was slow to understand that this was both a visual and visceral crisis. So I do believe that he's done a better job in the last couple of days. And Lisa Jackson is down there sampling, making sure that the government is sampling the water, sampling the quality of the air quality, so that it doesn't kill us necessarily. And that's why we've been so passionate about it. It is our way of life, all of us. So I'll just say this in closing, because now I see I got another. I want to just say in closing that it has been a great pleasure to not only take your questions and hear some of your ideas, and I have some key takeaways that I hope to go back and follow up on. And as always, I want to thank Dr. Smith for keeping me informed on all things Canadian. Once upon a time, I had 4 books from Canadian authors. I now have like 23. I think she's provided me with 12. And I appreciate that. And I also appreciate, as I said up front, the friendship of our 2 great nations. And we share more than just a continent. We also share common values of human decency and freedom and wanting to see the best for each other and equality for all. So I hope you had a wonderful conference, and I look forward to coming back to Canada. And maybe you'll see me even sooner if I hear that your jazz lineup includes some of my famous New Orleanians, like the Neville Brothers or, of course, the Marsalis Brothers. So God bless you all, and have a wonderful afternoon. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Before you go, I just want to give thanks, if you don't have to rush off. We are polite people, as you know, and we spend a lot of time expressing gratitude. I want to thank Concordia especially for its continuing generosity, for all of you for coming. A special thanks to Dr. Melinda Smith for being not only an excellent equity vice president of the Federation, but for managing, arranging, and finessing a whole week of fabulous panels on the most important issues that we've talked about today and that concern all of us, men, women, no matter what color, race, or orientation. They've been high grade. We've had parliamentarians, high-profile organizers, women in leadership positions, scholars, all contributing to what needs to be an extended conversation and translated into action. So please join me in first thanking Melinda Smith for all of her great work. And finally, to our distinguished guest, and Melinda deserves, of course, everything for having that friendship. Not everybody can claim a friendship with Donna Brazile, but it's a real kick to have been here, to put it mildly. I think we could be sitting here all afternoon. I'm not sure we're paying you enough to exploit you that way. In fact, I'm sure we're not. But all I can say, girl, is you rock. And...